From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
The Supreme Court finished its first term with Justice Gorsuch. The healthcare bill is stalled and has Republicans discussing radical ideas like not cutting taxes on the rich. And dueling studies offered opposite evidence about how minimum wages affect workers. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View. On the left is Gene Sperling, who directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. And our special guest is Emily Bazelon. She's a senior research fellow at Yale Law School and a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Welcome, everybody. The Supreme Court closed out its term this week with a high-profile decision that allowed part of the president's travel ban on people from six Muslim-majority countries to go into effect. Various lower courts had stayed the ban, but the Supreme Court will allow it to be enforced except with regard to people who have close ties to the United States. So, for example, if you're a Somali and you want to come here to the U.S. to visit your U.S. citizen daughter or to study at a university to which you've been admitted, that's allowed. But if you're just a tourist from Yemen, you won't be able to get a visa, at least for the next 90 days. More to the point, most refugees do not have strong ties to the United States, and their applications will be paused for 120 days. Emily, what did you make of this decision?
I think it's a kind of compromise. You can see that the justices, most of them at least, were trying to find some kind of middle ground here. Trump, of course, claimed victory. But the truth is that, you know, there weren't a whole lot of people from these six countries who did not have previous ties to the country who were getting in anyway. And so, you know, to some degree, this will just continue the status quo until October. And then there's this really interesting question about whether the case at that point will essentially be moot, because the Trump executive orders were for 90-day and 120-day reviews. And by that time, those reviews should be over and the administration should be talking about what actual policy it wants to make, as opposed to just preventing people from getting in because they say they're reviewing their vetting procedures.
Megan, does this feel like the lower courts overreached to you? It seemed like in the president's public comments on this had been so egregious that it almost felt like people were looking for reasons why the policy could not be legal.
Yeah, I think that had always been my impression, is that there is always a a blurry line between what people think is unconstitutional and what they think is wrong. There are lots of things that are in fact constitutional that I think are wrong, but we have often difficulty making that distinction. And I think that, you know, Trump's comments were egregious and courts didn't want to give him what he wanted. But there's a pretty good argument that the president has the authority to do this regardless of whether he's doing it for bad reasons. And I think that, you know, courts and their kind of enthusiasm to check the administration may have gone a little bit too far.
Gene, what do you make of that? I think, you know, Emily notes that this looks like an effort at a compromise. Obviously, so many institutions have become so political in the Trump era, and the Supreme Court, I think, has become a more politically polarized institution over the last few decades. It sort of feels like the court might have good reasons to try to take steps to insulate itself from some high-profile political disputes if it can.
Well, you know, it was interesting to me. When I saw the Supreme Court, I thought to myself, that's probably what they did was probably what the more serious career people would have done if forced to do something that Trump had wanted to do, but to not have it have the egregious harm. So it did have the feeling of kind of a bit of a more of a policy compromise. But I disagree on the following, which is, back in the day, I used to do a little bit of work on civil rights law. And one of the most difficult things is whether you can find that discriminatory intent, whether it's religious intent or racial intent. And normally, you have to uncover all sorts of evidence to imply the state of mind. Here, you had the person who was behind the ban tweeting and publicly saying it was a ban and it was religiously motivated. And yes, the Supreme Court courts can't overturn anything they don't like. But when what they don't like is instilled in our First Amendment, the very founding of our country on religious liberty, then they have an obligation to strike down laws that are motivated by religious animus.
Emily, what were your other highlights from this Supreme Court term? What did we learn? What were important decisions that came down?
We didn't have all that many important decisions. There was one at the end of the term about free exercise of religion, a religious school in Missouri that wanted to use state money to resurface its playground. That school won. And that is a victory going forward for people who want more government funds to go to religious schools and religious institutions. To me, the really big news coming out of this last week was that Neil Gorsuch, the newest member of his court, was very eager to make his presence felt. And that presence was very much on the far right of the court. So Gorsuch was a couple of times in concurrences or dissents with Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, and a couple times, you know, just making it clear that he had a lot to say and that he was eager to, you know, distance himself even from conservatives like Kennedy, who he clerked for, and from Chief Justice Roberts.
That religious school ruling that you mentioned actually had an interesting example of that, right? There was this one footnote in the what was otherwise the opinion of the court that Gorsuch and a couple other justices stepped away from, sort of to the effect of wanting to say that the decision might have broader effects than it looked like just from the decision, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts. And Gorsuch joined the rest of it. But what he and a couple of the other really conservative justices said at that point was they didn't want to make a distinction between funds going to the school for, like, resurfacing a playground or some secular purpose and funds that could also go to religious uses. And that's a step that the other justices weren't willing to take yet. It wasn't even a question that the case directly presented. So that was really striking.
Megan, what do you make of this decision? One thing that struck me is that Justice Breyer on the left of the court also found a way into this and basically said, you know, well, religious institutions, they get fire service, they get police service. This is another broadly available thing like that. We shouldn't read too much into it. But obviously, this relates to much hotter button issues about whether education funding, for example, ought to go to parochial schools.
You know, I think that it's really interesting if you look back into the 50s, like we sort of ended up with a very different interpretation of what separation of church and state meant than I think the founders had in mind. And part of that goes back to the kind of anti-Catholic movements of the 19th century. And part of it goes back to, you know, some of the atheism and public and school prayer cases. And, you know, I think that honestly, like if you look at other countries, it's not that big a deal. Right. If religious kids at a religious school are playing on government funded tarmac, that is probably not going to result in the establishment of a theocracy in the United States. And I think that actually this is an issue where the kind of elites who, of course, populate the court, among other people, are way more concerned about these really, really fiddling detail level things than the general public. And I think that, you know, Ben Sasse, for example, in his dissertation argued that, in fact, this kind of determination to stamp out every little tiny connection, no matter how vague or unrelated to the establishment of a church, actually caused a lot of a backlash. And that actually was one of the things that really pushed Republicans and towards the conservative side in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, in general, live and let live is an easier policy to run a society with. It's not a policy we seem to have a lot of ease implementing at the moment.
Gene, were you concerned with this decision or with the record that Justice Gorsuch put down more broadly this term?
Well, I think it's going to have an impact because for every Democrat that was told, you know, look at what a nice guy he is, look how polite he is, look how civil he is, what a decent guy. The fact was he showed himself to be in the Clarence Thomas camp of the court at the beginning. And I think that there's going to be I think it's going to strengthen the hand of those who are going to look past those type of issues and look very much to the substance of where the next Supreme Court justice will place himself on the court. Will they be more a Kennedy-esque type of conservative, or will there be another Clarence Thomas type of conservative?
Speaking of hot button issues, I want to address the health care bill, which seems to be stalled in the Senate this week. There was supposed to be a vote on it on Tuesday, but then Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that he would delay the vote because he had not lined up enough senators to pass it. He's caught between conservatives who want more cuts and more deregulation of health insurance markets and moderates who want to keep more of Obamacare and keep more funding for Medicaid and other things in their states. After the delay, McConnell's idea had been to spend this week negotiating, come up with a deal by Friday, and then vote on it after the July 4th recess. But if anything, Republican senators seem to be getting farther away from an agreement. Some have started to say that maybe they shouldn't repeal Obamacare's taxes on rich people, which would leave more money to spend subsidizing health insurance. Other senators, and now the president, are reviving the idea of just repealing Obamacare now with no replacement and hoping to come up with some sort of replacement within the next year. Megan, what do you think the prognosis is on this? Is this going anywhere?
It is really hard to say at the moment. You know, you have these moments in negotiations, right, where it looks like it's completely hopeless. And often you have a lot of moderates who are saying, I can't do this, I can't do this. But, those people are probably just holding out for some sort of symbolic thing that they can take back to their, you know, I got funding for opioids. I repealed this one little provision that you don't like. I think the person to look at is Mike Lee. He's going to be kind of the bellwether. If Mike Lee ends up as a hard
this
no,
is a the conservative senator from Utah.
Yes. Yeah. Senator Mike Lee from Utah. If he ends up as a hard no, then I think probably the bill is just not going to pass. If he ends up voting for it, then I think it probably will. But Obamacare looked similarly dodgy. I don't want to say at this point in its evolution, because Obamacare was a much longer process that lasted more than a year. But, you know, at the point where the Senate is getting ready to vote on something, there was a lot of time at which it looked as if nothing was going to happen. And then eventually they figured out how to do it. And I think that, you know, maybe Republicans will. I'm not quite sure why. I don't think this is a great bill for them politically or in any other way. But, they want to do tax reform and they want to block grant Medicaid. And this bill gets them closer to those two goals.
Emily, the funny thing to me as I watched this negotiation happen in the Senate is that, you know, you have all these negotiations over five fine points and people trying to get specific things for their states or broad changes like senators from states like Alaska and Maine want formulas that are more favorable to people in rural areas. But it feels to me like it misses the big picture, which is that the bill is built around cutting about $1 trillion out of government healthcare spending over a decade. And that means, to a first approximation, the bill means that Americans are going to have to come up with $1 trillion extra dollars out of their own pockets to pay for healthcare over that decade. And, you know, adjusting these formulas and moving a little pain from here over to here doesn't seem like it can get at the fundamental issue, which is it's going to be really unpopular if you do something that forces people to cough up an extra $1 trillion.
Indeed, especially if that $1 trillion is going back almost entirely to very wealthy people. So we have this competing dynamic. On the one hand, as Megan was saying, there's going to be momentum to pass this bill because Republicans have promised to do that. It's hard to be the person who, like, sacrifices themselves to being the vote that doesn't allow this bill to pass, if you feel some allegiance to the Republican Party and its agenda. On the other hand, this bill is going to do harm to a lot of people. As you said, it is deeply unpopular. And so that creates this counter pressure that would seem to just kill it off. And I think the problem for the party is that its tax reform agenda, which is dearer to the Republican Party heart and, you know, something they'd, I'm sure, rather spend time on, they've set it up so that first they have to pass this bill in order to get the kind of savings they want to make room for tax reform. And that, I think, explains why McConnell is even bothering with this.
We're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk more about healthcare. Let us know what you think about it on our Facebook page, or you can message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Jean Sperling, who has advised Presidents Clinton and Obama. On the right is Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View. And Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is also with us. So, Jean, one of the things that we keep hearing about healthcare is that if this bill finally dies in the Senate, then there's going to have to be some sort of bipartisan bill around stabilizing health insurance markets. Mitch McConnell puts this out there as a threat, basically saying to Republicans, well, if you don't do this, I'm going to go have to deal with Chuck Schumer. Senators like Susan Collins and some of the Democrats say it more as a hope that they would like to be able to move to some sort of bipartisan agreement. And I think about this and I just wonder, what would that even look like? Can you sketch out something that you think might actually get political agreement among Republicans and Democrats, assuming that this bill does not go through?
Well, Josh, I can understand why some Republicans would like a bipartisan bill. I mean, normally you're arguing, please don't do this cruel policy. But the problem is it's very politically popular. Here you have a bill that kind of meets at the highest intersection of policy cruelty and political stupidity. This bill is getting as low as 12% approval ratings. So if I were Republicans in the Senate, I would, of course, be looking for some way out. The reality is, Josh, is that, you know, unlike when we were defending Medicaid back in 1995 under President Clinton, Medicaid's become much more popular. People understand 64% of people on nursing homes get Medicaid, that 35% of people with disabilities get Medicaid. So when they hear a 35% cut in Medicaid, a lot of people are going to think a lot of people in their families, their districts, their states are going to be hurt. So I think there are enough people in the United States Senate that would probably like to get out of this terrible situation they're in and work with Democrats on a solution. It's a lot harder to imagine the House of Representatives going along with something, but it is what the public would like. They would like to mend, not end, Obamacare. It is now more popular dramatically than the Republicans' proposals. It is much more popular than Donald Trump. And now that people are used to not having discrimination against pre-existing conditions or gender and having a sense of affordability, even when times are down for them, it's not something people want to give up.
Mm-hmm. Megan, what Gene mentions there, sort of if you combine this funding for what they call reinsurance funds, which is actually in the Senate bill, but it's this thing Democrats want where basically you provide subsidies that encourage insurers to enter markets. It's supposed to help promote competition, hold premiums down. If you did that and then you combined it with something Republicans wanted, like that HSA thing where you give more tax incentives for people to put money in health savings accounts, the problem with that seems to me is that costs money on both sides. You do something that Republicans wanted to spend on, you do something the Democrats wanted to spend on, and you get a bill that increases the deficit, whereas theoretically one of the key points of this healthcare reform bill was that Republicans wanted to reduce public spending on healthcare and wanted to reduce the deficit.
There's two problems with it. The first is that it increases, it costs money. The second is that that's really asymmetrical. And, you know, Republicans complain, not unfairly, that Democrats have a history of offering these compromises. Like, we'll do Obamacare, you can pick what color healthcare.gov's website will be, right? And then complain that Republicans won't compromise when what they're offering is very little. You know, I think if you combine something like the reinsurance funds with Medicaid block grants, now that is a deal that you could probably do. I don't think Gene Sperling would take that deal. And that's really where we are, right? And if you look at, you know, the control of Congress is more volatile than it has been at any time since the post-Civil War era. And there's very little incentive to compromise. Each side is hoping that the other side will get voted out of office. When you're in the minority party, instead of saying, well, I'll help you pass this, give me this, you say, I'm going to wait because I'm going to have control in 5 years, you know, 4 years, 8 years, whatever, and then I'll do my list by myself. And so I think that the potential for compromise is really small precisely because you're not going to get anything. You're going to get Democrats offering, like, you can have bigger HSAs, which we shouldn't have cut in the first place because it was kind of spiteful. And then you're going to get Republicans saying, well, I'll tell you what, you can pick the color on healthcare.gov as we block grant Medicaid and cut a bunch of money out of subsidies. Those aren't compromises. And the fact that no one can come up with anything that is a meaningful compromise is exactly what the problem is.
So the thing is, Emily, if Megan's right about there about the difficulty of compromising, and you really do have significant problems in the insurance markets established under Obamacare, not in every state, but in a substantial number of states. And there's been sort of this assumption, well, you know, it's unsustainable and they'll have to do something about it. But a lot of states had really screwed up health insurance markets before Obamacare, where it was basically impossible for a lot of people to buy their own health insurance if they didn't get it from work. So, I mean, is that what Megan painted there? Are we headed for a time where we just have a lot of healthcare dysfunction and a lot of people pointing fingers at each other, but that doesn't actually act as a forcing mechanism to get even a temporary fix out of Washington?
That is certainly possible. And Megan, I think, is right about some of the political incentives. So if the private healthcare market crashes and burns, then Democrats come back into power. Those are two big ifs. But if those things happen, it's going to be pretty hard for Democrats to argue, hey, this private insurance Obamacare idea, which was originally, you know, a conservative idea, came out of Massachusetts when Mitt Romney was governor. Let's try something like that again, as opposed to let's try a buy-in option into Medicaid or Medicare, or even something like Medicare for All. In other words, the move further left could really gain more momentum behind it if this private market-oriented option, if Republicans don't participate in stabilizing those markets.
I want to talk some about the minimum wage because there was some interesting research that came out this week from Seattle. In recent years, a number of cities, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle, have set local minimum wages that are substantially higher than the state or federal minimum wage. Seattle requires $13 an hour for many kinds of businesses, and that's scheduled to climb to $15. The federal minimum wage is only $7.25. Over the last few decades, the consensus among economists about the minimum wage has shifted. Pure economic theory would tell you that minimum wages should reduce unemployment among people with low skills as employers decide it's not worth hiring them at the mandated wage. But empirical research that has compared jurisdictions that raised their minimum wage to jurisdictions that didn't has tended to find surprisingly small unemployment effects from the minimum wage, and in some cases, no effect at all. But we got these sort of two studies with different conclusions out of Seattle this week. Gene, what do you make of this controversy?
Well, I think that from my point of view, and I know Megan may have a different view and has a different study to cite, but I think for many of us who believe in the fight for 15, Seattle is looking as strong confirmation that when you're doing this type of significant increase, particularly in a city with a high standard of living, that there is a lot of evidence now in Seattle that this does good. Not just for wages, but then does good for wages and has no negative employment impacts. Now, the people at the University of Berkeley who did this are some, Michael Reich and others are some of the top minimum wage experts in the country, and they had a far superior study, I believe, than the one from the University of Washington, which says something different. And theirs, because they looked at the entire food industry, which is very much what Card and Kruger looked at in their seminal study, and they look at it everywhere. They don't exclude, as the Washington study does, 40% of industries because they have multiple locations. You exactly want to look at the food industry with multiple locations. And what they found was that wages had risen 1%, 2.3% in limited service restaurants, and that it had little impact on employment. Right now, Seattle is doing well. Their unemployment level is going down. And I think Seattle, despite the University of Washington study, is right now looking like a very strong case that this type of significant minimum wage increase towards 15 done in major cities like Seattle can be a win-win for wages and jobs.
Megan, the thing I'm getting about the dispute over these studies is you sort of get both sides claiming their data is better. And this University of Washington study, which found that there had been a significant reduction in hours worked for people with low wages, such that they actually made less money, even though their wages went up because they were working less. They had this new data set where they got to look at individual workers rather than sort of survey summaries of workers. And so their point is, yes, it excludes part of the market, but it also has much more detailed data on the workers they have. And that's why they feel more confident in their finding that the minimum wage really is having a significant negative effect on work.
Yeah, I think there's no question that their data is better. And it's sort of weird to criticize them for excluding multi-site employers and then say, but look at the food industry, which is an even more restrictive thing to look at than all of the workers in Washington. The reason they excluded multi-site employers is, in fact, because they had better data. So what they said is we can't tell where, with multi-site employers, we can't tell where these workers are. And because that data is not broken out, it's broken out by employer, not by location. And so because of that, they exclude those people from the set. But they also sort of look at survey data and say that large employers were actually more likely to say that they'd cut jobs in response to the wage increase. And, you know, I think that this is one of the really telling things is that they say, why do we differ from Card and Kruger, which is indeed the seminal study that has been sort of relied on by people who are saying we can do a $15 minimum wage, it's not going to cost jobs. But they say, look, if we do, if because Kardin-Kruger didn't have as good data as they do, because Washington is one of the few states that collects this kind of very granular data on individual employees, they say if we do the study that they did, if we replicate that with our data, we get the same result.
Which is to say, so they don't find a minimum wage effect if they use the old methodology, right?
If they use the old methodology, but when we look at individual workers where we can break out who is low wage, right? Because one of the big problems with the study that's done by a liberal policy shop that's affiliated with Berkeley, which the mayor of Seattle weirdly went and commissioned after the study that he had originally commissioned came back with the results he didn't like. They can't say who's high wage and who's low wage. All they can say is you work at a restaurant. Well, you know, there are people at restaurants who make a lot of money. There are people who make a little money. The people who made a lot of money probably weren't affected. Maybe they got a wage bump, but those low wage workers, we don't really know because, again, the only people who had that granular data are University of Washington.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Emily Bazelon, what's on your mind?
I am really worried about this commission supposedly for election integrity that President Trump created after he came into office. Mike Pence is in charge, but the person who's really directing it is Kris Kobach. And this week he added to the commission Hans von Spakovsky. So Kobach and von Spakovsky, between the two of them, they're the kind of twin architects of voter suppression in this country. And they've asked for all the publicly available data about state voter rolls. And, you know, given their track records, the notion that we could be seeing purges of voter rolls in a way that could make it harder for people to vote, people who are legitimately registered to vote, that seems like a really real possibility to me right now. And, you know, there is no more important issue than free and fair elections going forward. So we need to all watch this and make sure that is not threatened.
Gene Sperling.
This has never happened before, Josh. I have the exact same rant. Vinita Gupta, who's the new head of the Leadership Conference for Civil Rights, has said that the Pence and Kobach letter that they sent out is, and quote, laying the groundwork for voter suppression, plain and simple. Four or five states, including California, Virginia, Kentucky, Massachusetts, have already said no. You know, it's worth me not changing my rant because this is outrageous.
Megan McArdle.
I feel like the loser kid because I don't have the same rant as everyone else. You know, President Trump came out and said, okay, well, maybe this repeal and replace thing is a bad idea. We should just do repeal and replace later. Now, this was exactly the plan that Republicans had when he came in. Everyone knew what had to happen. You go in, you pass the repeal that they've already done, and then you hopefully put pressure on Democrats to cooperate on a replacement. Trump is the one who forced them to put together these horrifying bills that they've had such trouble negotiating. And now, you know, 6 months in, he has learned that it was a bad idea. I think this is really symptomatic of the problems with his presidency, where he is learning on the job, but he is not learning fast enough to get anything done.
I have a reminder that this might be the last time you hear only a half hour of Left, Right, and Center on the radio. Next week, we begin a new era of our civilized yet provocative conversation and take it up to a full hour. We were having a hard time fitting all the news into a half hour, so we hope your local station will be able to make room for us in their schedules. That is all the time we have for today. I want to thank Megan McArdle, Gene Sperling, and Emily Bazelon. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Berskins is our production assistant. I am Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.